Will the crypto market cap be worth $200 trillion one day? When will Amazon start taking Bitcoin as payment? And are upwards of 95% of all cryptocurrencies scams? Today on the show, we welcome New York Times bestselling author and prolific investor James Altucher to the mic, and he's going to share his thoughts and his opinions. Now, we loved our time with him, and you will too. So settle in for a deeply engaging and entertaining hour-long conversation with the James Altucher on this episode number 47 of the Bad Crypto Podcast.
Who's bad?
And good day, people of Bad Cryptopia. Welcome to our domain, which is badcryptopodcast.com. Joel Com here and Mr. Travis Wright over there. Hi, Trav.
Hello, hello, hello. How is life in your world today, Mr. Joel Com?
Life is good in Denver. I think the sun is shining and we're up early today because we finally got a yes after a few shout outs on the show from the legendary James Altucher, who's going to be joining us here shortly.
We literally only shot out messages in the show. Somebody heard our show, reached out to James, right? Is that how that happened? And then
that's how they
emailed us and said, hey, James wants to be on your show. We literally didn't ever contact him outside of the podcast.
His people called our people, and then we all people got together.
We have people? Are you hoarding all the people? Joel's over there hoarding all the people, I guess.
Well, we have the people of Bad Cryptopia that are here, and this is episode 47, but just a few episodes down the road is number 50, which is a fantastic milestone. Congratulations, Mr. Travis, right?
Thank you.
You almost made it there.
Yes, we're almost 50. Is that over the hill?
Well, considering I'm 53 years old.
No, it's not over the hill yet. Over the hill is 54.
I sure hope not.
Over the hill is 54.
We're getting a bunch of calls from you, but we need more in order to make episode 50 our salute to our fans. We just want to make this so much about you guys. So please call us and leave a message anywhere from 10 seconds to 30 or so, and tell us whatever you want. Tell us how crypto's changed your life, how the Bad Crypto Podcast has changed your life. Tell us what coins you like. Tell us to stay bad. Sing us a song. Tell us a joke. Whatever. As creative as you want to be, okay? But don't think, hey, this is for everybody else to do. No, this is your mission, should you choose to accept it. And here's the phone number where our voicemail receptionist will greet you. It is 708-885-9030. 708-885-9030. Amuse us. Call us.
Because we love you guys and we want to hear from you. So, I mean, there's a lot of people in our mastermind group. There's a lot of people in our Telegram group. So bless us with your voice and share with us your thoughts. Yeah, so we want to hear from you guys. So give us a call at 708-885-9030. Do it.
Before we get into the interview, how about a quick shout out to our sponsor this month, Travis?
Yes, Zilla. It's a new ICO marketplace app, and it's kind of like a mix between Amazon and Reddit, but for ICOs. And what's cool, if you go to zla.io/bad, you can see that basically this is an app to invest in ICOs with one click. That's what it wants to do. So you can browse the ICOs, you choose your payment method, then you get your token. And they say some of the reasons why this is important is because there's no difficult wallets to deal with. There's no chances of using fake Ethereum addresses. There's none of those links that are going to pop up in Slack to scam you, and no website spoofing, that type of stuff. So it's a great way to browse ICOs, upvote and downvote them, so you get to see which ones are rising to the top. And if you like an ICO, you should be able to participate using various tokens and even a credit card with just one click. So that's going to be coming out here shortly. You can actually pre-register for that Zilla beta app at zla.io/bad.
This is just great fun. And I got to say that when we started this interview with James, he wanted to start it. And so the guy, he has a lot of words and he has a lot to say. These are not just words filling up empty space. I mean, the dude is super smart, and you're going to want to listen to every word of this interview.
I mean, we covered a wide range of topics, not just crypto stuff, but also some really interesting philosophy and life stuff. So this is definitely one that you want to listen to. If you don't listen to the whole thing all at once, pause it and pick it back up later on, because this is the longest Bad Crypto of all time so far.
And worth it. And so James says, let me know when you start recording. And then he proceeded to hijack the interview. And this is how that conversation went.
This is James Altucher taking over real briefly the very beginning of Joel Combs and Travis Wright's podcast. Joel, I want to say first, you totally ruined my life.
How did I do that, James?
Well, when I was kind of depressed, this is like 15, 16 years ago, all day long, I would play Yahoo games. Oh, and perfect. One by one, I would try to master every single game. So I'd go from checkers to backgammon to chess to hearts to bridge. And I think there was even a Yahoo Go, but I'm not sure. I don't know if that's for sure. But I would just spend all day long either day trading, which was stupid, or playing on Yahoo Games, which was created by you.
That's absolutely fantastic. Did you use the icon of the guy with the red cap, goatee and glasses?
I can't even remember. This is 2002. And yeah, the market was going straight down. And I literally, in order to survive, I had to make 100% a month. And I philosophically don't really believe in shorting the market. I would be going long in these markets that were going straight down. And the only way, and I had so much anxiety, and the only way I could deal with my anxiety was by, so maybe you saved my life. The only way I could deal with this anxiety was by playing games. I can't play a game without trying to master it. So I'd buy all these books on like hearts, and you wouldn't even think there are books on hearts, because it's like kind of almost like a simple-minded bridge, but it's actually a very complicated game. But I would buy all these books on all these different games. I would try to master each one. And then can I tell you what happened next?
Please.
So I got good at all these kind of standard games. And so I started thinking, boy, it would be great to have an idea of a book, which is how to beat your friends and family at every game in the universe. Because by then I really knew how to like all the simple tricks to win every single game. You know, it kind of set me off on a path of not writing books about games, but on constantly having new ideas to try to improve my life, because I felt my life was such in the gutter that the very first idea I had to improve my life was to make this book on games.
You know, this is probably the best start to an interview ever, because in there was Joel Combs saved my life, and
you know, and Joel Combs ruined my life. So there was such a dichotomy in that.
Right, such a dichotomy. At first you ruined my life, but then it kind of showed me the light that was near the end of the tunnel, which is that, oh, I actually should come up with more ideas than just day trading the market and playing games, that ideas themselves can be the clues to finding my way out of this dark tunnel I was in.
You know, I want to just drop the mic right now. By the way, I sent, while we're talking here, because we're recording this on Skype, I sent you an image of the icon, and I want to see if you recognize, because the guy with the red cap, that with the yellow Y on it, glasses and a goatee, that was actually me on Yahoo Games. And it was the first one that would come up for people when they sat down at a table. So people find out years later, oh yeah, I used to play as you.
So you're saying that was the Tom of MySpace, the Tom MySpace of avatars for Yahoo back in the day, huh? Yeah, that became your friend. Very nice.
And Tom, by the way, being a good friend of mine, but just name dropping there.
Well, we're going to drop your name for a second.
I saw that you sent the image. I can't find it for some reason.
Don't worry about it. We're going to drop a name here for those of you just tuning in. The guy who kicked off this interview is James Altucher, And James's Wikipedia page says everything except Joelcom ruined and saved my life. But it does say that he's a hedge fund.
But hedge now fund. Now you could be a certified source that says Joelcom ruined my life.
Yeah, okay, but we have that on recording. Can you just say for the record, Joelcom saved my life?
Joelcom saved my life.
As the sirens going off in the background.
New Facebook promo for the podcast.
I know. That's fantastic. Well, you know, listen, you guys want to learn everything about James. There's so much on his Wikipedia page. You guys, an entrepreneur. He's a best-selling author of 17 books. He's a venture capitalist. He's a podcaster. He's failed at 17 of the 20 businesses that he's founded or co-founded. Those three successes, though, that's what we're really going for, the home runs. And he's had a fascinating career. He is totally down with this whole crypto thing right now, and that's why we've invited him to be here. Thanks for joining us today, James.
Well, thank you guys. I really appreciate it, and I'm excited about cryptocurrencies. You know, unlike you guys, I don't follow like the second by second news about cryptocurrencies, although I am very, you know, neck deep in what currencies I love and what I think are going to be explosive. But I have a very philosophical bent towards why cryptocurrencies are going to succeed and which ones are more likely to succeed than others. And also, I do think most of them are scams and are going to fail. Like, I'm not like this, you know, I see all these newsletters, find the next penny crypto that will go up 10,000%, just like Bitcoin. And I think most of those are just, you know, criminal enterprises. And I think just like when the dot-com bust busted, I think most dot-com companies failed. The same thing's going to happen in crypto. But just like Amazon, eBay, Google, Priceline, and a bunch of others, you know, created trillions of dollars in value, the same thing's going to happen with cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, there's a lot of parallels between that, you know, the stock market bubble back in the day and where we are now. There's people who are trying to make that correlation, but you just nailed it where you said there were a few of those companies, you know, not 90% of them. There was less than 10% of those companies that became the eBay, the Amazon, the Google, right? And they've evolved over time. I want to ask you this here, because you mentioned this not too long ago, James, where you said that you foresee the cryptocurrency market cap eventually reaching upwards of $200 trillion. Is that a real estimate? And how did you come to that number there?
Yeah. And it's funny because, again, I really reject any kind of salesy language. And that almost feels very salesy, like, oh, you know, $200 trillion opportunity, catch it right now.
Yeah.
You know, here's this. If you just look at the history of money over the past 5,000 years, and I'll give the 60 second 5,000 year history of money. Barter was too complicated for real legitimate transactions for various reasons. We don't have to go into it. Precious metals replaced barter because it became a little harder to forge money. You can't really forge a precious metal if you're using scales and other equipment, and they're more scarce, so it's harder to mine precious metals. So precious metals solved a massive problem in barter, but now precious metals had a problem. It's hard to move large amounts of precious metal if you have wealth, if you're a king with wealth and your kingdom was just defeated, but you want to preserve the wealth and move around. It's hard to do that. It's hard to have large transactions, like if you buy a house or whatever. And also there is a limited amount of precious metals in the world. So eventually whoever mines, whatever country happens to be lucky enough to mine enough precious metals will always be the most powerful country. So there's problems with precious metals. So again, money always solves a problem from the previous generation of money. So we got government-backed currency and often precious metal-backed currency that was then backed by governments. So the U.S. government would say this dollar bill is backed by $1 worth of gold in Fort Knox. So paper money that was more like a debt obligation solved the problems of precious metals. We can carry around a large amount of paper money without, you know, having to carry 100 bricks of gold on our back. So paper money in its various forms, you know, in banks, non-precious metal backed but just government-backed precious metal, paper money solved this massive problem from the previous generation, which was precious metal-backed money. And now paper money, which is no longer backed by precious metals, is only backed by government. Paper money has huge, huge problems associated with it. I mean, we're kind of acclimated in the U.S. to think that paper money is okay. But if you look at many other countries, like all of South America, all of Asia, Russia, Germany, many African countries, many of these countries have had problems, such problems with paper money that it almost caused, and in some cases did cause, the downfall of their entire governments and you know, massive depressions and recessions.
And it might actually be a misnomer where it's not necessarily paper money now because it's not backed by wealth. It's a paper currency where it's maybe not money now, right?
Well, it is money in that it solves all of the definition of money. Like, it's a, you know, a store of value, a way to transact goods. It's a unit of measurement, but it's only backed by the trust of the government. So we've seen even in the past 10, 15 years, 20 years, so many governments, because of various problems like human error, for instance, you know, like the central government printed up too much, as an example, we've seen these governments topple because of the weaknesses of their paper money. And so ultimately, forms of money evolve to solve the problems of the prior generation of money. So that's why we're seeing cryptocurrencies evolve now. Cryptocurrencies are evolving to solve the problems, the massive problems of paper money. They were not created as an investment vehicle. That's the problem people need to realize. They were created to solve the problems of the current generation of money, which is government-backed paper money. And you know, some of those current problems are obvious. Like there's the potential for human error, like the central bank of a government might print too much. There's the problem that potential forgery. There's the problem of potential double spending in the current banking system. There's friction in the banking system. You know, if I send money to you and you're in China, there's six different banks in the middle between you and me. And there's transaction fees at every level. So that creates inflation in the system. There's another problem, which is anonymity. If you're in China and I'm here and I'm buying something big from you, every single government agency between here and China is aware of the private transaction between you and me, and maybe even some non-government institutions. So there's massive problems in paper money. And again, in the US, we're sort of like, we ignore a lot of those, but we're lucky, and we're lucky so far. But most of the world has experienced in a very personal way, in a very horrific way, the problems with paper money. And so cryptocurrencies have evolved to solve these problems. And people say, oh, well, isn't this just another fiat currency? No, I mean, if you look at the source code of Bitcoin, which is the most popular cryptocurrency right now, that source code is maybe 1,000 man years of mathematics and science behind that. Like, these are, there's real value in the source code of Bitcoin. And of course, many of these other cryptocurrencies, which are pretty much based on the grandfather of them all, which is Bitcoin. So, and of course, one great thing about cryptocurrencies is that each cryptocurrency, to determine if it's valid or not, it should use this philosophy also. It should say, does this cryptocurrency solve a problem potentially created by other cryptocurrencies or other paper currencies? So that's where you see the evolution of not just Bitcoin, but other perfectly valid cryptocurrencies.
Science. So, James, I want to know, how did you go down this crypto rabbit hole? Because we all heard whispers of Bitcoin before we actually started paying attention. What's your story?
Okay, well, and I'm just being straight out honest. Like, I was, let's say, in 2012, which you can already argue was too late in some cases. I mean, Bitcoin started a few years earlier than that, and many people became very wealthy just in those first few years. But it's not too late. It wasn't too late then, and it's not too late now. But in 2012, I was a skeptic. I was like, oh, who's going to use this? How could you make such a psychological shift from this answers I'm going to finally answer your question from before, which is why 200 trillion? There's $200 trillion worth of paper currency and gold bullion in the world. And eventually, I think that's going to be replaced by the problem solver, which is cryptocurrencies. So that's why I think cryptocurrencies will eventually be $200 trillion worth.
Does that include derivatives and whatnot?
No, that does not include derivatives.
Okay.
So derivatives will be a much larger world, of course. So, I mean, derivatives on currencies could be, I don't know, $250 billion.
It could be way higher than $200 trillion. That could actually be a small estimate, potentially.
But that's a really good point. And also, that $200 trillion number doesn't include contract law, which is almost too sophisticated. I don't want to say it's too sophisticated to explain, but contract law is an important part of how Bitcoins are constructed. And so the entire evolution of the legal system will evolve in the direction of cryptocurrencies as well. But that's sort of another topic. But my own evolution in this is that I was a skeptic, like many people in 2012. I sat down with a friend of mine, Naval Ravikant, who is the founder of AngelList. He's also the founder of CoinList, which is, you know, where kind of the most prominent initial coin offerings are happening. He's a big advocate of cryptocurrencies. He's also an incredibly smart human being. I mean, again, AngelList he created to solve a massive problem, which is the venture capital dominance over investing in startups. He's also a seed investor in Uber. He was a seed investor in Twitter, seed investor in many well-known startups. So he's also heavily involved in cryptocurrencies. So back in 2012, I sat down with him and I said, okay, I have an open mind. Just explain this to me how it works. So he's probably spent like the whole day just going over everything from the basics of cryptocurrencies to, you know, its use in contract law and other potential uses of it. And you know, he was patient with me. He would answer even my inane questions like what happens if quantum computers solve the cryptographic, you know, cryptography issues with Bitcoin and so on. And what happens if China takes over 51% of Bitcoin? So he answered maybe 1,000 questions for me and explained from beginning to end. And I really appreciate that. And so I decided to test things out. When I was launching a book in 2013, a book called Choose Yourself, I figured, well, I'll make this. I'm going to choose myself first. So before I released it on Amazon, a full month before I released it on Amazon, I created a store that only accepted Bitcoin, and I sold my book on this store. And the funny thing is I did sell quite a few books that way. Two funny things happened. One is most of the people buying the book, I could, you know, they would put their email addresses so I could email them a PDF of the book. And most of the email addresses were from Amazon.com, which sort of showed me even then they were looking at what is this Bitcoin thing. And the other thing that happened was I got asked to be on CNBC to talk about it, and they were skeptical. They said, did you just do this for marketing purposes? And I answered, well, I'm just going to be honest. I am on national TV right now, so I guess it worked. If that was my
right.
So that was my first entree into Bitcoin, and you know, I've studied it ever since. And then I didn't want to, you know, if you read my books and articles and stuff, I don't really talk about finance that much because I don't want people to think that's the primary way to make their lives better. It certainly wasn't the way, you know, even when I was having my deepest money problems, it certainly wasn't the way I made my own life better. So I didn't really want to answer lots of questions about not only stocks, but esoteric questions about cryptocurrencies. But I see now so many criminals in the space, either criminals launching coins or criminals starting public companies in the space or criminals, you know, putting out these stupid newsletters. So I figured, okay, for once, I'm going to write about this. I'm going to explain everything I know. A lot of it is for free and available. And then some things I've hired a team of experts to help me. So some things I charge for, but I'm trying to just eliminate what I think are the or at least compete with what I think are the scams in the industry.
Oh, that's great. I have a question because I've read a couple of your books. I think I've actually probably read three. And I have my 16-year-old son. He's actually reading Choose Yourself, and then he's got Reinvent Yourself is going to be one of the ones he's going to read as well. He just turned 16. And I want to just kind of – I'm going to come back to some questions about crypto, but real quick while I'm thinking of this is what would you say to somebody who is now almost entering college age? Because I know that you've had some conversations. You've talked about this on what you think someone – coming right out of high school should do. do? Should they go immediately $200,000 in debt on a college education for their kids? Or, I mean, what do you think that young kids should be working or thinking about right now as we're entering this 5G world right around the corner, and cryptocurrency and blockchain and, you know, AR, VR? There's such an interesting space that we're moving into. How do the kids, how do people want to think about navigating that?
Well, it's a great question because, you know, there's so many people out, like, I've lost friends over this question. Like, I'll say something like, kids shouldn't go to college. And literally just that one statement has caused me to lose good friends, which maybe you can argue they weren't really true friends in the first place. I don't know the answer.
Wow. But, just don't get into political discussions. If you're losing friends over that one,
yeah,
they would drop like flies.
Although maybe that's a good filter to see who your good friend, who your real friends are or not. You know, tuitions have risen faster than inflation every year since 1977. So it's not just that they've risen every year, they've risen faster than inflation. And the reason is, there's probably a lot of reasons. One is that the law requires certain jobs to have college degrees, like a law degree, like being a lawyer or a doctor requires you to have various degrees. So it's like the law holds some people captive. And if you're held captive, it doesn't create a free market and prices go up. The other thing is that the government has backed many student loans. So the government has encouraged, you know, either implicitly or explicitly, college presidents to raise tuitions pretty fast every year. Because it's no mystery, student loans are the one loan you can't get rid of in a bankruptcy. Why is it that loans that are taken out by 18-year-olds are the most punished by the government? It's inexplicable to me. So just kind of the economic basis of college right now. I mean, it maybe was worth it in the 1970s in terms of value. But right now, certainly with corporations, you know, kind of eliminating their middle management and many jobs not even requiring college degrees, the actual value of a degree has gone down while tuitions have gone up. So then you could say, well, you know, then there's a lot of other arguments, but for most, let's just take the economic though. And I know not everything's about money. You know, there's other benefits to college, but the actual economic benefits of college have disappeared, other than like a doctor or lawyer or some degree that is irrationally requiring by law a college degree. What job requires a degree? Actually requires you to know something that you learn in college.
Yeah. And a lot of times now is, you know, you people who have gone to college, like I went to college. And the thing is that most of what I do on a daily basis has nothing to do with what I learned in college. And it's almost like, yeah, you really, and a lot of times the jobs that are being created in the next 10 to, you know, 5 to 10 years, they don't even exist yet. And so that's what I'm instilling in my kids is, look, you really have to remain curious. You want to be a lifelong learner, because school in a lot of ways will tend to beat that love of learning out of people, I found. So it's really hard to keep that curiosity.
Yeah, I agree. Like we could, you know, on the one hand, so I went to school a while ago. I majored in computer science, which you think is a craft and a skill that should be learned in school. So and I did well enough, you know, that I got into a great graduate school. So I put in my 10,000 hours programming while in college and school. And yet when I actually got to a job, I was so bad at programming, they had to send me to a remedial school for programming in order to learn the basics of surviving at that job.
Wow.
So the real world is very different than the academic world. And I went to a good college. I went to a good graduate school, one of the best in the country. I still had to take these remedial classes. And now the situation's even worse because they don't really teach courses on, you know, how to make a cryptocurrency or how to understand one or how to make a good virtual reality or the state of the art in artificial intelligence is so far beyond, you know, what's being learned at the top graduate schools that, you know, I'd probably even be able to lecture a graduate school on the state of artificial intelligence. And it's just, you learn in the real world. Now, what about the arts? Well, if you want to be an actor, you can take a lot of theater classes, or you can move to New York and audition every single day and see if you like the lifestyle of being mostly rejected, but then occasionally accepted and building up your resume. And by the time everyone else graduates acting school, you will have been on some plays, you will have experienced the lifestyle and decided if you like it or not. And you'll be, you know, literally 4 years ahead of your compatriots. Now, the other story I have is I've been a writer. I've written 18 books. Some of them have been bestsellers, and I've been writing since in the 1990s. I didn't start writing or even reading like serious works of literature until after I'd already left graduate school. So like you said, be a lifelong learner and school exists forever. You don't need to just learn during those 4 years.
I went to U of I in Champaign, and pretty much school was just a party for me. I've got a degree in speech communications, never intending to become a public speaker. And I've never used that degree. And it just so happens that I ended up becoming a public speaker. But I don't recall that I've actually used anything that I learned in college, because I don't think I went to class.
Doing things actually teaches things. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to do things in college, but you can do things in the real world, because then you could see the effect of those things on real people. You can start a business, you can write a book, you can be an intern for somebody, or, you know, start at the bottom of the totem pole at some corporation. You know, people say, well, not everyone's meant to be an entrepreneur. I get it completely, but okay, you could try being an artist, you could try being an actor, you could try being a writer, or you could try even working at a job. You're ultimately going to be judged on the success of your efforts rather than your grades in school. And everybody knows that, and nobody seems to act on that.
Yeah, try stuff, do stuff, see what you like, and then do analysis on the data to figure out where you want to spend your time. And that winds me into this next question, because you've had a really interesting discussion about how we've moved into this world of dataism, from theism to humanism and now to dataism, because wars are being fought with data. If you could maybe explain that a little bit, I think our users will find that fascinating, and how that applies into the crypto world.
Right. So that's a great question, because I talked about the history of money and it makes sense, right? But there's a more important theme, which is that in every industry, you can look at a transformation in the past, let's call it 12,000 years, between a growth from theism to humanism to dataism. And, you know, like, let's take medicine. If I was feeling pain, you know, let's say in my stomach or whatever, I would think to myself, oh, the gods must have punished me. And if I pray to God, or if I make a sacrifice, then God will maybe cure me if I, you know, can overcome what, for whatever reason he or she punished me. And, you know, or I would go to the shaman or the local priest and they would pray for me or make something and cast some spell or whatever. So for a long time, we believed in theism in the medical industry. And then we started to believe correctly in humanism, which is that, okay, some humans will become experts at medicine and they will cure me. I'll go to them and they'll cure me. And sometimes that didn't work because, you know, we had the whole era of leeches, bleeding out illnesses and so on. As we got more knowledgeable, you know, humanism got better able to cure illnesses. So now I can go to the doctor and he can say, okay, you have a cold, take 2 aspirin in the morning. Or the doctor could say, okay, you know, you got a bullet inside of you, we're going to use surgery to get it out. And the human would do surgery and I'd get the bullet out. And then now we're seeing this evolution into dataism. So I'm feeling sick. Now I need to get blood tests or an MRI and then or an EEG. I'll get some data. And the data, you know, one step further is the data might be pattern matched against a database of other MRIs. And I can see specifically what condition I have and what medicine has statistically proven to be of best use to these MRIs that my MRI matches. So there's lots of work still happening in this, but data is being more and more the source of, and, you know, we're even seeing robot surgeries being performed where most of the surgery, most of the really in-depth and intricate parts of a surgery are being done more accurately by robotic surgeons. And, you know, there's huge companies being developed as a result. And this is just the evolution of things. If you look at war, originally, two countries would go to war. It all was about which god was the stronger one, and they would do these big sacrifices and whatever. Then war was about how many humans can we put in each other's country to fight it out. Whoever had the more humans and bullets would win. But now war is being fought almost 99.9% over data, and it's being fought every single day. We saw a glimpse We saw like a photo snapshot of it with the elections. But I can tell you the war with data is every single day. If you're in Eastern Europe, for instance, every single day, some country is trying to bring down the electric grids of those Eastern European countries, and they are trying desperately to figure out how to stop it. And so that's just one example. I can give a thousand others, you know, but data currently is how war is being fought. And we can do this across every industry, but let's take a look at money. So money, just if you look at the dollar bill, in God we trust. So theism becomes our way of trusting, you know, having faith in the dollar. But it wasn't enough. So then we started putting George Washington on the bill. We have the signature of the Secretary of the Treasury. We have a picture of the White House or the signing of the Declaration of Independence. You know, if we trust the government enough, now that's humanism. And that's our faith in the dollar is backed by humanism. And then there's a little more with data, which is now they do all these things to prevent forgery and so on. But ultimately, you know, Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, they only exist as data. And that's the evolution of how money will occur, just like it's occurred in every single industry.
I think it's going to full cycle around to back to thumb wrestling again to solve problems and, you know, the old fashioned way. All this is above my pay grade, but appreciate your thoughts on all this. I think this is really important stuff. OK, I want to get back to the cryptos here for a moment, because you said on this show and many other times that you think 95 to 98% of cryptocurrencies are scams, outright scams. So what we want to know is, which ones do you think are worth paying attention to? And are you a licensed financial advisor? Because Travis and I are not, and we don't give financial advice.
I am not a licensed financial advisor either. I did run a hedge fund for many years, and I ran a fund of hedge funds. You know, you need to be a licensed financial advisor if you're going to place clients in who aren't accredited investors. If you're going to place clients in securities, so like a stockbroker has to be a licensed financial advisor. You and I, if we're not stockbrokers or if we're not placing people into regulated securities, we do not have to be licensed financial advisors. It doesn't mean we know more or less than anybody. It just means we don't have that government issued license to put, you know, somebody who calls us into Google stock. We just don't have that legal ability to do that. That's all that a licensed financial advisor.
We don't know anything. That's why we're the Bad Crypto Podcast. And but so which ones are you paying attention to? Which currencies other than Bitcoin?
Sure. Well, first off, you can't completely ignore Bitcoin, although that's the obvious one. But Bitcoin has, and I don't mean to be overly wordy about any of these things, but like Bitcoin has problems also. And let me ask you a question. Why are there multiple paper currencies? Why is there a US dollar and a Canadian dollar? Like, what's the difference between them? Why are there two currencies for largely the same purpose?
Well, that's just geographic spacing, yeah. And sovereignty.
Sovereign nations, yeah.
Right. And why is Canada not part of the U.S.? It's just because in 1770, they decided, you know, we approached them and said, why don't you be part of the U.S.? And they're like, nah, we're good.
Take off, eh? Posers. We don't want you.
Yeah, get out. We have moose.
Nor beer.
Yeah. So that's why there's a Canadian dollar. It's totally artificial historical reason. But with cryptocurrencies, there's what I call use borders. So there's only another cryptocurrency that's valid because they have a border defined by its use. So Bitcoin, I think, has a strong use because it was the first, it's the biggest. It kind of defined the structure of what a cryptocurrency looks like. And pretty much every other cryptocurrency since then has followed that architecture. But, you know, of course, the second biggest, which is Ethereum, it sort of takes Bitcoin and it takes the... I won't get too complicated. It takes Bitcoin and it makes it much easier to make contracts, what's called smart contracts, on top of a cryptocurrency. So Ethereum is very much like Bitcoin, but with the added ability that you can make contracts. So, you know, we can make a crypto coin that's called the Joel coin. And anybody
I actually have, by the way, there actually is a Joel coin. There's a million of them on the Waves platform that I've done nothing with.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, Waves is also a crypto, but it's a platform. And for one wave, you can create your own coin on it that basically has its own currency and you issue them. I think it cost me at that time $4.50 to create a Joel coin. And I said, okay, let there be a million of them.
And he's given none to anyone. He's being very greedy with the Joel coin. I'm at least hodling them all.
But this is very interesting because what's the use of a Joel coin?
There is none.
Right. So the Joel coin is valueless.
It's a shit like coin, right? It's a total shit coin.
It's kind of like our bad coin. I don't know if you saw that, James, but we produced 10 billion bad coin, and our listeners, they post on our page or send us an email and they ask for them, and we send them bad coin. I think we're going to have 1 billion in circulation pretty soon. And there is no, we tell people they're valueless. They are the ultimate crap coin.
And there is a bunch of coins like that. And it's amazing actually how they've been driven up in the marketplace as investment vehicles when even the founder says there's no use to this coin. Like, I don't know how to pronounce it, but the D-O-G-E coin.
The Doge coin. You know,
the Doge coin is like another example where the founder basically says there's no, I did this as a joke. And yet it got up to like a several hundred million dollar value, overall value of all the coins on the marketplace, which is ridiculous. It should be worth zero. And the guy even said it should be worth zero. You know, coins should have problems that they solve. Bitcoin, for instance, has a problem with anonymity. Now, if you and I make a Bitcoin transaction, you know, it's sort of anonymous. You can't see who transacted with who, but we can see the size and the time. So it's not anonymous enough for certain huge entities like a government to use Bitcoin. So if a government was using Bitcoin for some nefarious purpose, like buying weapons from another country or paying off another country or whatever, Bitcoin probably wouldn't be the right coin for them to use. So they'd have to find another coin that's a little bit more anonymous. Now, some coins out there offer more anonymity. You know, one of these I might not, but like Monero and Zcash offer more anonymity. You know, Ethereum, I mentioned before, is certainly a good coin because it allows you to make more use of the contract facility that's embedded within Bitcoin. It makes a meta language for contracts, so it's easier for people to create coins that have specific contractual use. So Ethereum is another good one.
I want to pose a question right in there when you're talking about Ethereum, right? So Ethereum, you know, it's based out of Russia, right? So we know that.
It's not really. The founder's Russian.
Founder's Russian. But I have a question about this. So now there's all these ICOs that are being built on this one platform. Does that concern you in any way that if there was something that could go wrong with that Ethereum blockchain, there could be so many of these companies and these ICOs that are relying solely on that platform? Is that something that concerns you at all? Like maybe there's a backdoor or something happens down the road? I mean, that could crush the crypto space if Ethereum had some major problems.
So two answers. One is, yes, that does concern me a little bit, and I think solutions will happen. I think it's worthwhile looking at Ethereum Classic also because that contains a lot of the same functionality, but it's cheaper to make a coin on top of Ethereum Classic if you could solve some of the backdoor issues. In terms of so what you mean by a backdoor is that some hacker could come in and manipulate or steal a bunch of coins that are built on top of Ethereum. The current Ethereum, you know, has had, you know, thousands of programmers look at it. You know, there's no backdoor as far as the best programmers in the world could see. Mm-hmm. And I think just like Bitcoin, I think that's like a done coin, meaning you'd have to really like search far and wide to, there's no backdoor. It's pretty secure. I mean, you can't say anything for certain, but you know, it's as if you've had 1,000 Einsteins look at something and say, okay, this is fine. So Ethereum in general, though, I think is worthwhile to own. I think more coins, there's a lot of utility to it because more coins are being built on top of it. You know, it's like the internet. So why did the internet get popular? It's not because we could download pictures of porn, although that was a driver of early.
No, it was Yahoo Games. Yahoo Games did it.
Yeah, exactly. Games can be that popular. But the internet's popular because it allowed for you to create other protocols on top of a fairly simple network. So there was a network that connected computers, and oh, we can build an email protocol. Oh, we can build a file transfer protocol. Oh, we could build a hypertext protocol, which became later called the World Wide Web. There were a lot of backdoors and insecure parts of the internet And more software replaced those backdoors, but we still use the internet. So I think the same thing will happen with both Bitcoin and Ethereum are like the internet of money. They're like the internet protocol of money. And more protocols will be built. And by protocol, in this case, I mean alternative cryptocurrencies will be built on top of those basic coins.
In your book, you talk about a way to approach investing in crypto. In fact, I must be being targeted because of crypto, because I see your ads on Facebook all the time. There's James with his smiling face, and don't miss the next big boom. I've got a copy of your book, Cryptocurrencies 101, How to Make a Fortune from Digital Currencies, in my hand. You've got a three-step process for this. Can you talk about that?
There's two things that I look at. Why the investment opportunity exists, which is still, we're still in the beginning stages. So I describe why I think $200 trillion worth of paper currency is going to be replaced by cryptocurrency. And any kind of boom like that, the people in the beginning make the most wealth. Now, the people in the end make massive wealth also, which is why people are still making massive amounts of money on the internet. But the people in the beginning will make the most wealth. And we're still very much, very, very, very much in the beginning of the cryptocurrency boom. We haven't even had the flush of the bad cryptocurrencies. So we're before inning one, really. We're in inning zero of the cryptocurrency boom. And that's really the important thing of those three steps. But, you know, the other thing that's really important is, you know, understanding, and I don't know if this matches the three, but here's what I try to do. Understanding what the use of the currency is and how big is that use. So Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general solve a massive problem. That's why there's the demand for money is $200 trillion. And that's and cryptocurrencies solves such a large problem in currencies that it'll satisfy all of that demand eventually. The other thing is, how are new coins created? You have to really understand for each cryptocurrency how a new coin is created. So with Bitcoin, we know very clearly how new coins are created and how many can ultimately exist. Only 21 million Bitcoins can exist, you know, by the end of its history. And then you have to understand how is that enforced. And this involves, you know, because you don't want there to be a backdoor where the founder of the coin can reach in and pull out another 21 million, because then that will, you know, dilute confidence in the coin, which is why with paper currencies, that's the downfall of most paper currencies, is that a few guys at the central bank call each other up and say, hey, let's print a trillion more of these. And, you know, they don't consult us. Yeah. And then
quantitative easing. Let's keep going with this quantitative ease. Let's keep those printing presses on, you guys.
Right. So in America, again, we got kind of lucky that somehow it didn't really devalue the dollar. But in other countries, it devalues their currency huge. And that's why, again, all of South America crashed in the 80s. All of Asia crashed in the 90s. All of Russia crashed. All of Germany crashed in the 20s. Zimbabwe crashed a decade ago. You know, on and on and on. I can name almost every country has crashed at some point or other.
Eventually, we will crash, in theory.
You know, maybe in theory, we will crash at some point. But cryptocurrencies are here to solve a problem. You see in Venezuela right now, and even in Argentina, as the currency starts to get more and more shaky, the population says, hey, there's an alternative. There's Bitcoin. And so that's when you see the Bitcoin start to rise in prices. Whenever Argentina gets a little volatile, everybody moves to – nobody wants their wealth seized again. They still remember the last time their wealth was seized.
Mm-hmm. Zcash is pretty big down there too, right?
Yeah, because it's anonymous. So just disclosure, I'm a seed investor in Zcash. Figured I would just drop that in there.
No, that's one of those interesting coins that has a low volume of, it has a low quantity of coins, an interesting price. It solves a big problem, and it's always looked like an interesting one to pay attention to as well.
It solves a massive problem, and it solves it in a very sophisticated way that even other currencies that are attempting to do anonymity won't do it as well as Zcash, at least so far.
I want to ask you a question while we're talking about some of the sophisticated elements of this. And you mentioned this earlier when you were chatting with your friend, the founder of AngelList, and you asked about quantum computing. And so that's been one thing that I've had that question as well. And I'd love to hear what your answer is on that, is because quantum computing, what happens when it gets to that point when it can start, you know, breaking that 256 hash. Does that put Bitcoin and these cryptocurrencies in danger? I know that's been a lot of things that we've had people ask us that question a few times as well. So I'd love to hear what you think about quantum computing and crypto.
Two things. One is we're very far from, we're 10 or 15 years or more away from hitting quantum computing, even if it's possible. I mean, it's theoretically possible. But we don't know if it's practically possible. I mean, quantum computing basically says there's an infinite number of alternative universes out there, and we're going to put a computer in each one that's working in parallel to each other, and we'll solve any massive problem because we have infinite computation on our side. So that's kind of like theoretically possible in this almost science fiction universe, but no one's even come close to practically executing on it. So we're not even
okay.
It's not like self-driving cars where, it's theoretically possible. And yeah, here's a self-driving car. It's in Google's.
Which is not around the corner yet. We're talking maybe 2030, 2035.
We're talking maybe 1,000 years from now. Who knows?
Okay.
But let's say it happens. Let's say it happens because we want to look at the worst case scenario. Bitcoin has the ability to what's called fork itself. And presumably if there's also solutions out there for what cryptography. Look, cryptography fuels the kind of secrecy of Bitcoin. Like I can make a transaction. No one could break into it. No one could forge it. No one could steal my money because of this cryptographic component. And there's cryptography for quantum computing. And Bitcoin can just fork itself into a stronger version of cryptography. So that's a very solvable problem.
Okay, very good.
Well, let's get into a controversial area because you are very vocal about, what you think about crypto, and your ads are popping up all over the place. And a statement that you made recently, and you can tell me if it was misquoted, but my understanding is that you were certain, absolutely certain, that on the earnings call with Amazon in October, for those that are listening in the future, the earnings call October in 2017, that they were going to announce that they were going to start taking Bitcoin. It didn't happen. So is that what you said? And what do you think in retrospect?
I said two things. One is Amazon will certainly at some point accept cryptocurrencies. And I know this just because, for one thing, other retail stores are taking it, like Overstock.com. And second, I know the interest inside Amazon towards cryptocurrency. I saw it firsthand when I set up a Bitcoin store back in 2013. Now, I said as early as October 26th, because simply that's when they were having their earnings call. There was no special reason for me to think it would happen on the earnings call. It's just that was the next time I knew Amazon was talking to the public, and cryptocurrencies have been so popular, it made sense that it might happen as early as then. But what we've seen only within days of that earnings call is that Amazon actually has registered a bunch of cryptocurrency related domain names. I mean, that was about 6 days. It was like last Tuesday.
We talked about it, I think, on the last show, didn't we, Travis?
We did.
Yeah. So here's the question, James. Is it going to be, are they going to do like Overstock and start accepting Bitcoin, or is it going to be their own coin?
I think they'll first off start accepting Bitcoin because I think they're going to want to play. They don't want to do something that's going to cost them potential money or bad reputation. So Bitcoin is something that works and it's the biggest. So more people have Bitcoin than any other cryptocurrency. It could be the case that Amazon plays around with their own cryptocurrencies afterwards. But first things first, let's get our feet wet with Bitcoin. And so by the way, October 26th was just, last Tuesday. Wasn't that Halloween? That was October 31st, right? It's only 5 days after my prediction of saying it could happen as early as October 26th. Well, it happened 5 days afterwards that Amazon indicated that, we're going to start playing around with cryptocurrencies. So
how soon? If you are going to be the prophet and pull your crystal ball out, when do you think it will happen?
I would say certainly within the next year and, as early as, call it February, which is when their next quarterly call is. Could happen even earlier than that. But I think the fact that now that they've registered these domain names, they've basically raised their hands and said, okay, we're definitely in the space. This is definitely something that's happening. Whether or not, whatever the exact day is, they suddenly open up shop for Bitcoin, doesn't even matter. They're already saying they're taking it serious. The largest store in the world says they're taking this extremely seriously. And that means we should take it seriously as well.
And as a follow-up to that, then, it's been my belief that when Amazon does that, we move from this pioneer early adopter phase to the very beginning of the mass adoption curve. Is that how you see it, where the big boom in Bitcoin is really going to happen?
I think that will be a boom. I think the fact that the CME also just announced that they'll be trading Bitcoin futures, that means they take it seriously as an asset class. I think, though, where you're really going to see the biggest boom is when the population of a country finally gives up on their government-issued currency and the population itself, against the wishes of their government, switches to Bitcoin. So like in an Argentina or Venezuela or some country with a lot of currency volatility, switches finally to a Bitcoin or some cryptocurrency. I think that's when you're going to start seeing the biggest boom. I mean, because already a lot of retailers accept Bitcoin. A lot of online retailers accept Bitcoin. Amazon, of course, would be the biggest, and that will make a move. That will send a PR signal to the crypto world that this is real. But I feel like they've already done that. I think what's going to be biggest is when you see a population adopting it for actual transactions. I mean, let's just talk about the downside of cryptocurrencies right now. It's not like I can go out and pay for a cup of coffee with Bitcoin. So we're still far away from common usage. And that's the same was true for the internet. It took a long time before people were willing to put their credit card into the internet and use it for transactions. So I think it's a process, but it's a process that's going to happen. And if you want to make money on it, then it's better earlier. You know, they always say the two best days to do something is today and, I don't know, 5 years ago or 20 years ago. So we all missed out on 5 years ago or 20 years ago, but they're still today.
Well, you have a lot of people out there that are making all kinds of predictions. You know, of course, John McAfee says 500,000 in 3 years. Of course, that is now 2 years and 8 months until he has to do that horrible thing. If it doesn't, you've got others saying it's going to go to 1 million, some saying 25,000. What's your 3-year prediction?
I mean, it's always hard to do that. Like I did that just to establish some credibility. I did that with Facebook in 2007. I went on CNBC. I used to write a column for the Financial Times. And in one of my columns, I said Facebook is going to eventually be worth $100 billion. And at that time in 2007, this was August 2007, Microsoft had just offered $1 billion for it. Mm-hmm. And so people thought, how could he say $100 billion? And so I went on CNBC and they literally were laughing at me. Like they were laughing hysterically at me. But for me, Facebook seemed like this mini internet. And so if you looked at the value of the internet and divided by some, number, you would come to, potentially 100 billion. And they had me on again when Facebook went public. Its first price after its IPO was 104 billion. And so I was right. Now, I've also made predictions that were wrong, so I'm not saying I'm a prophet. But on the things that I love the most, I tend to be maybe a little bit more right than wrong. Hopefully, I'm knocking on wood because I'm superstitious. but I would say, like everyone says, oh my God, cryptocurrencies have gone from 2,000 to 7,000 in the past 2 months. It might go, it might go back down to 2,000. Cryptocurrencies are very volatile right now, although Bitcoin's the least volatile. But I would say, I don't know about 500,000. That seems like kind of a number picked out of a hat. It'll hit 500,000 eventually. It has to. If it's going to hit a $200 trillion demand, eventually it's going to hit millions and millions of dollars per cryptocurrency, per Bitcoin. But I'm willing to say like 50,000 within a year. Like certainly that's possible if a government collapses and Bitcoin takes over or everybody starts transacting in Bitcoin on Amazon. Certainly 50,000 is possible.
Yeah, I just did the math there. So if it was $200 trillion total market cap, and let's say Bitcoin was 40% of that, because there's going to be all these other cryptocurrencies, that would be one Bitcoin would be about $3.8 million. But let me ask you this. Which is the right Bitcoin, right? So we have Bitcoin Segwit 1X. 2X is about to fork. We have Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin Gold. There's these other forks that are happening. How should people be looking at that? And how should we be thinking about navigating those forks?
If you want to just get involved and you don't want to, it's okay to not do the heavy research here. You don't need to know about every single cryptocurrency, and most cryptocurrencies that are out there, like I said earlier, are going to fail. If you just want to get involved, sign up for Coinbase, which is a crypto exchange. I'm sure you guys have talked about it before, and it's probably the easiest one to use. And just buy some Bitcoin, maybe buy a little bit of Ethereum. So I have a newsletter about what cryptocurrencies to buy, and I'm happy to say that the first and the biggest one I recommended was Bitcoin. And even though it's the biggest, it's also the one that's gone up the most in the past month, even though there's hundreds of other cryptocurrencies. So you're not really going to go wrong with Bitcoin. And then there are plenty of others, and some of them are riskier. And, I don't necessarily want to recommend anything, I don't want to hurt any listeners.
But I think these forks confuse people about what's happening. Like, which one do you think is, I mean, because the, you know, Bitcoin now has SegWit 1x on it. Now they're doing a fork with 2x. And then Roger Ver seems to think that Bitcoin Cash is the best one that's most similar to Satoshi Nakamoto's. So I think that there's some confusion. We've had so many questions about those forks and what they mean and which one ends up going to be the real one, which obviously
will
there's
the
only
real
one
Bitcoin,
that's BTC.
Please,
right?
Stand up.
Yeah.
Well, the real Bitcoin is the one people should buy. So Bitcoin Cash, the entire reason for Bitcoin Cash is to make it faster to process a Bitcoin transaction. So you can actually go out there and buy a cup of coffee with Bitcoin. But there are other coins out there also that have fast transactions. And we haven't yet seen the shakeout there. So Bitcoin's the standard. I don't think you can go, again, you're going to experience volatility. If you buy it today, it might go down, it might go up. But in the long run, Bitcoin is going to be higher than it is now, even if you experience massive volatility along the way. So Bitcoin Gold, for all I know, is a scam. It doesn't make sense to me. Bitcoin Cash, I understand, but I think there's a lot of competition on Bitcoin Cash, including Litecoin, which is also available on Coinbase. So again, I would just stick to the real Bitcoin. And if you, by the way, if you're in the real Bitcoin, then every time there's a fork, you get for free some of these other coins, and you can either keep them or sell them and buy more Bitcoin.
Free monies, yo.
Free money.
Well, James Altucher, thanks so much for joining us today. We got one more question before we set you off on your way to enjoy the rest of your day. And this one really is more of your personal philosophy about being healthy in all the different arenas, physically, emotionally, creatively, spiritually. What's your approach to just, you know, life in general? Because we know that it is not all about the monies.
Yeah. In fact, honestly, money is just a side effect of living a good, what I call choose yourself sort of life, not, you know, taking control of your own power in your career, in your personal life, in society, and so on, and having freedom that way. You know, I've made money, I've gone broke, I've been at my worst moments, and I had to figure out what works for me when I'm making money and what doesn't work. What am I not doing when I go down? And it's so simple, it's almost a cliche, but people don't really think about it. So there's four things. One is, the first is physical health. Like, if you're sick in bed, you're not going to come up with ideas. So you have to keep yourself healthy. And that boils down to just eat well, sleep well, move well. There's emotional health. You know, there's a cliche saying, which has truth to it, which is, you're the average of the five people you spend your time with.
Mm-hmm.
Spend time with people you love and who love and support you. So that's emotional health. There's mental health, which Joel Kahn, you put me down the path of when I started writing ideas of, well, what I hear, I'm dead broke, what can I do with my life? And the very first idea I wrote down was, well, let's make a book about all these games I've been studying. And then from that point on, every day I write down 10 ideas a day. Back this morning I did it. I wrote down 10 predictions for cryptocurrencies over the next year. And for 15 years with some starts and stops. And usually when I stop is when my life falls apart. But for 15 years, I've been writing down 10 ideas a day, because the idea muscle is a muscle. If you don't use it, it will atrophy. So you have to write down 10 ideas a day, and then it compounds. That muscle gets so strong, you turn into an idea machine. And it really works. I've gotten thousands of people writing me saying, you know, I didn't believe you at first that it was a muscle, but now I see. It's like an amazing thing. And then finally, there's spiritual health, which is like almost a bad word because people think spirituality is like praying or meditating, which it might mean those things. But it really just means coming up with ways to notice when you're overly anxious, because anxiety will only steal energy away from your ability to solve problems in the future. And so coming up with strategies to deal with anxiety and regret and kind of surrendering to the things you can't control is really important. So you can come up with ideas and you can find the people you love and you can stay healthy rather than being curled up in a ball anxious. Now, I will address one thing, which is people say ideas are a dime a dozen. Execution is everything. And that's true. But execution ideas are a subset of ideas. So if I have a good idea, well, what are the next 10 steps to implement that idea? Like, let's say I have an idea. Oh, I want to write a screenplay. Okay. The next day, I'll outline the 10 scenes in that screenplay. Okay. The next day, I'll start writing. I'll come up with, 10 pieces of dialogue that these characters say with each other in that screenplay and so on. Execution ideas are just a subset of ideas. And you can't come up with good execution ideas unless you already have a well-developed idea muscle. That's my approach to freedom. And I will say money is a side effect of that. If you do that every day, for me at least, I only tell my own story. For me at least, money has been a side effect of that.
Oh, that's absolutely beautiful. I would actually make one a book recommendation that I picked up recently that kind of falls along those lines, where most people spend most of their time in the brain waves in beta state, right? Where there's that 20 cycles per second and it's very noisy there. But there's a subset of folks who have learned how to think in the alpha state, which is 10 cycles a second. And I think that's what's happening when you're going into these states and you're thinking about, these ideas. You have eliminated the clutter in your mind. You've gone into the sort of meditative state. There's a phenomenal book out that's called Silva. It's by originally the dude Jose Silva, but it's called Ultramind, and it's this intuitive guidance system for business, which recently came out a couple of weeks ago, and it actually teaches people how to actively get into that alpha brainwave so you can get in that 10 cycles per second so you can think clearer, you can make better decisions, and you actually have more intuitive guidance that way. So I think that's something that might be fascinating to you.
I haven't heard of the book, so I'll definitely thank you for the recommendation. What's a recommendation? What's the first step towards getting into that alpha cycle, well, other than like kind of meditation?
That's actually the key to why meditation is important, which hit me upside the head with this when I was reading this, is because once you close your eyes, you eliminate all the inputs that you're seeing. And so a lot of your brain processes is seeing and trying to decipher all that it is seeing and processing that in real time. You close your eyes and then you imagine your body relaxing, complete relaxation, and you say 3-3-3. You imagine your skin, everything relaxing that goes through this process. And then 2-2-2, that is you relaxing your brain. And then once you close your eyes, you've relaxed your body, you've relaxed your mind, boom, now you're in that alpha state. And there's a few processes out there that help that. But
I love that. I do 3 to 6 times a week. I go up on stage and I perform stand-up comedy. Wow. And I think I'm performing tonight, actually. I'm gonna try that tonight.
Yeah, very nice. I've actually performed stand-up comedy averagely since 95. So that's awesome to hear.
It's on my bucket list as well. So it's encouraging to hear that you do that. I've been writing down things that I think are funny, as as they tell you to do. And one of these days I'm gonna do that. But by the way, Travis, what you don't know is that James Altucher's actual superhero identity is he is Ultramind. Yeah,
that could be. I don't know. I'm not smart enough. I just, everybody should use whatever benefits they have. So I happen to look smart. I happen to look smarter than I am. So I have to use that to my advantage. Some people, use looks for different things. If you look strong, you should use that to your advantage. But I look smart, so I try to use it to my advantage.
Well, we're glad you joined us today, James. Thanks a lot for spending time with us. Where's your favorite place for people to connect with you online?
If you Google "I want to die," then I'm like usually either the number 2, the number 3, or the number 4 result, depending on how Google reads your cookies. And you can find me from there.
Wow, that's a negative manifestation. I don't want to die. I'm going to Google that.
Well, from a stoic point of view, I'm ready to, you can always say it's the best thing is to be ready to die any second.
Oh, there you go. So, very nice.
Well, you guys can find all kinds of stuff about James at his website, jamesalltoucher.com, and there's a ton of books. You've got me outnumbered on books at the moment, but I'm number 15 is coming out in 2018, so I'm going to try and catch you.
But Joel, you made Yahoo Games. You did. Okay, back in 1992, I helped create ICC, the Internet Chess Club. I don't know if you probably know it because you have your experience.
Yeah.
But we were thinking of making different, you know, this was pre-web. So we were thinking of making different servers for each game. And you really simplified the whole process and did it with your classic games and then sold to Yahoo and what became Yahoo Games. You did my dream from the early 90s. So
well, I have to give a shout out to Aaron Jacopi, who is my partner that actually was the brains. He coded the whole thing. And I found him when he added his Springer Span games. It was a small little site that three of his friends were testing with him. And my webmaster said, you should check this out. And I did. And I went to Aaron. I said, let's grow this. Let me market it. Let's rename it and see what happens. And so I was the marketing force behind it. And he actually went to Yahoo and became their chief game Yahoo in the acquisition and got vested. And I think he got out before things collapsed and is probably living happily ever after right now.
Man, well, you did a good job. Congratulations. And you guys strongly were an influence in my life. So happy to it's amazing how the dots connect.
Always. It is.
If you live a good life, the dots connect more and more.
That was amazing. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you, guys. You guys do a good podcast. It's always good when it feels like more of a conversation than an interview. You guys do a good job.
Mr. Travis Wright, that was a super fun conversation with James. I didn't know exactly what to expect, but the dude can carry a show.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things is that I think that the preparation that we had for this one was solid because, you know, I just naturally I've read a few of his books and I read another one of his books last night and was going through and we had an amazing conversation. I think that was one of the funnest interviews from all the podcasts that I've done on all of my shows. That I think that was my favorite one.
And I think it's going to be a fan favorite as well. Write us and let us know what you guys think. You can go to badcryptopodcast.com and click the contact link. And give us your feedback there. Of course, we've already told you how to reach out and call us. But that number, once again, is 708-885-9030. Or if you want, you can just send us an email to badcryptopodcast@gmail.com. Connect with us on the socials. Our Telegram group is rocking with over 370 people now there at badco.in/Telegram. And we'd love to connect with you guys there as well. And those of you that are waiting on your Bad Cryptober Bad Coin distribution, well, it's taking place. In fact, many of you probably already have it in your wallet. So make sure you check your BitShares account to see if it's there. And those of you that don't have it yet, you should have by the end of the week. And if for some reason it falls through the cracks, you don't get them, then write us at badcryptopodcast@gmail.com. And we'll make sure to get those to you because you got to have your worthless Bad Coin.
Yes, and what's so fun about that is that my kids were the ones helping send them out. So we're teaching them all about the cryptos. So
it's a family thing.
It's a family affair.
And on that note, thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode. Please tell a friend about Bad Crypto Podcast because the world needs to know to stay bad. The Bad Crypto Podcast is a production of Bad Crypto LLC. The content of the show, the videos, and the website is provided for educational, informational, and entertainment purposes only. It's not intended to be and does not constitute financial, investment, or trading advice of any kind. You shouldn't make any decisions as to finances, investing, trading, or anything else based on this information without undertaking independent due diligence and consultation with a professional financial advisor. Please understand that the trading of Bitcoins and alternative cryptocurrencies have potential risks involved. Anyone wishing to invest in any of the currencies or tokens mentioned on this podcast should first seek their own independent professional financial advisor.